This is The Full Spectrum. The show provides a wide range of news and competing opinions. The commentaries, beliefs, and viewpoints expressed by segment hosts and guests do not necessarily represent those of WJSU-FM, Jackson State University, or its administrators. The content of this program is for informational and/or entertainment value only and not meant as an endorsement or recommendation in lieu of professional guidance on relevant topics.
It's the full spectrum. We've got news.
Entertainment.
Interviews. And so much more. It's the full spectrum.
Correspondent Ron Nixon about his book, Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Welcome to The Full Spectrum for Tuesday, October 25th. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. Let's begin by checking out the weather with our own Meredith Michelle.
All right. Happy Tuesday to you, Dwayne. We are at 82 degrees right now, sunny skies in the capital city, looking for a low of 53 degrees tonight. Wednesday calls for partly cloudy skies, a high of 84 with a low of 62 expected, and a slight chance of some rain on Thursday. I know we've been talking about that, so I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
All right. New York Times Washington correspondent Ron Nixon is the author of the book Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Nixon says that the South African government spent an estimated $100 million a year on a campaign of disinformation to keep the racially divisive system of apartheid going. I sat down with Nixon to discuss the book.
Apartheid is a really broad subject. So when you decided to do the book, how did you narrow in and tell the listeners what the premise of the book is?
Right. The book is called Selling Apartheid. And the premise of the book is that the South African government sold this ideology of separate development for blacks and whites the same way you would sell any product, soap, soda, pop, you know, depending on where you live. There was no different, that they hired marketing firms, they hired public relations firms, and basically it was to sell the world the idea that blacks and whites in South Africa wanted to be separate and wanted to live in their own spaces. So there's been a lot, as you mentioned, that was written about the propaganda as well. But what I wanted to do was like, well, who were these people that represented the South African government and why? Because one of the things I found in the research was that there were a number of African Americans who worked for the apartheid government.
Well, I was going to say the kind of campaign you're talking about would have, I think, had to have been international in scope in order for it to be effective.
Yes, it was global. I mean, they operated in the United States and various places in Europe. I mean, they spent in Japan, Australia, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars over between the period of 1948 all the way up through 1990. And even when Mandela was released from prison, it was still targeting and attacking him. So it was, they did things like they tried to buy the Washington Star, which was a newspaper in Washington, D.C., that was a rival to the Washington Post. They tried to buy it and turn it into a propaganda piece. They created a political party in Norway, just created their own political party in Norway to go to support. They hired African Americans in the U.S. to put in both liberals and conservative. It wasn't just like it was just conservative African Americans. There were very liberal folks as well.
To what end? I mean, the machine, to keep the machine running is one thing. How much of it was ideological as opposed to just the power grab?
For which side? For the South Africans?
Yeah, for the South Africans.
Well, it was that, you know, South Africa is majority black, but the white government, which was a real, real small minority there, in order for them to hold on to power, they needed to have this international support. Otherwise, they would just be overwhelmed by the number of black people there. There's just too many, and arms and, you know, killing people, that would only get you so far. I mean, you got to have the support of the major powers. And at this point in time, you know, who was the superpower in the world? It was the United States. And so they tried to make sure that they kept the United States in their orbit, as well as the United Kingdom or Great Britain, because South Africa was a former colony of Great Britain.
Right. So, but I guess what I'm asking is, you know, there's power for power's sake, and then there's the idea that I am superior to you.
Right.
You know, you need to be ruled.
There was both of those things. It was the fact that they had come there. These were former, for the most part, the Afrikaner government were former Dutch settlers who had come there and developed their own language and culture. And there were whites who were from, you know, England and other places as well, but they felt that this was their God-given right to do this because they felt like they have built this country. They came there and these people were savages and they hadn't done anything, so they're the ones who built this country. And at the time that this was all happening, most of the world was like this, that, you know, blacks were treated this way everywhere.
Right.
So it wasn't surprising that they would think that way because, again, most of the world that was non-white at the time was either colonized or in the process of being colonized by one of the major powers.
So we know that when you spend that much money for a campaign like that,
right,
there has to be some counterpoint that brings that campaign to a crashing halt. And how significant were the highly publicized uprisings and killings that happened in the 70s, you know, in South Africa?
Well, you know, throughout, from the time the apartheid government came into power in 1948 through the 90s, there were these uprisings. I think the more significant ones were in the 60s. 1960 with Sharpeville,
right,
and then in the 70s with Soweto, and the uprising,
which I remember,
right,
when that was
right
happening.
And so, you know, that was a major turning point, both Sharpeville and Soweto, because at the time, you know, people had TVs, and you could see this now, whereas in the 40s and 50s, you had radio primarily. But now you could visually see the violence, and you could see what was happening. You could see, you know, children being gunned down and women being gunned down and people with no weapons being gunned down. And the only reason that they're being gunned down is that, well, they just want to vote.
Right, but what was happening to the machine at that time? So you've got this group of people who is working to keep this apartheid regime in place,
right,
and yet at the same time, these major international, you know, the international reaction to these events had to be kind of a problem for the machine, right?
It was because, you know, even solid allies like the United States and the United Kingdom condemned the killings. And then the United Nations, you know, passed, you know, resolutions condemning them and trying to push for sanctions. And it just, for the apartheid government, it looked bad because now you can't argue that, well, these people want to be separate. Like everybody in South Africa wants to be separate and be in their own. But you can't argue that now because now you see people out protesting, people dying, saying that, look, we're being excluded from vast swaths of the country. That's our country. So the machine then starts to adapt and try to come up with other ways of dealing with the protests globally.
Why do you think it resonated so much, especially, I'll talk about, you know, what I remember happening. Why did it resonate so much with Americans? Because if you look now, there's always something going around in the world. You can look at Aleppo. There's not the same kind of coalescence around that issue as there was at that time around apartheid, you know, banning apartheid, disinvesting from South Africa.
Right. I think one of the reasons is that because as a result of the civil rights struggles in the United States, by the time in the 70s, when a lot of this was happening there, you had a growing and very vocal congressional black caucus that saw this as an extension of, you know, bad U.S. foreign policy, but also an extension of the civil rights struggle. You know,
right.
for a lot of blacks, South Africa resonated because it's something that blacks in this country understood. It was white versus black. Even though you had a place like in Uganda where Idi Amin was probably killing more black people than
right.
South Africans were. But people understood that whole idea of white versus black.
Right, and white supremacy.
Right,
and
white supremacy, right, and colonization. And so that was what resonated with the CBC and then, you know, but even before that, I talk about in the book that the people don't really know that Martin Luther King was very, not just very active, but led efforts to impose sanctions against the South African government. I mean, and gave speeches and chaired a global movement with the former First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt. To impose sanctions against South Africa. I mean, and as a result, they banned his speeches and stuff in South Africa and wouldn't let him come to South Africa, even
that
though
he was fascinating.
Yeah.
When we come back, more of my interview with New York Times correspondent Ron Nixon.
For more than 20 years, Hope Credit Union has provided responsible financial products and services to families and businesses across the Mid-South. You can learn more about Hope's work to create financial opportunity for people and communities in the nation's most persistently poor regions at hopecu.org. Together, we can improve the lives of people in our community. Together, there is hope.
Support for WJSU comes from the Mississippi Link. Each week, the Link has connected, integrated, and communicated urban, rural, and community news from around the globe to people of Mississippi and beyond. And now its website provides daily news and events at MississippiLink.net. Welcome to your world.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. We return now to our interview with New York Times correspondent Ron Nixon, author of the book Selling Apartheid. Before the break, we were discussing Martin Luther King Jr.'s role in battling apartheid, and Nixon tells us he wasn't the only family member engaged in that fight.
And his father, you know, Martin Luther King Sr., had invited the African National Congress to his church. So there was a long history there that, you know, Malcolm X would always bring up in his speeches, the fact that South Africa was part of this global colonization and this is an example of white supremacy and the U.S. support of this. So, you know, these were people that you don't hear a lot about their support of the movement there, but it's a long history. I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois was somebody who took on apartheid. A. Philip Randolph, I mean, Paul Robeson, all of these people. Paul Robeson was the co-founder of an organization called the Council on African Affairs back in the 30s,
right?
That fought against the South African government even before apartheid became officially the policy. So they were fighting against pre-apartheid government in South Africa. So it's a very long history. You know, Joe Lewis showed up at an event Madison Square Garden, Joe Louis, the African-American heavyweight a champion, Lena Horne, Miriam Anderson, the opera singer. They all supported, trying to help South Africa. So it's a very long history. It's not something that just happened in the 70s or 80s.
Right. And when you think about it, though, people like Paul Robeson, Lena Horne, they had a voice.
Right.
They were not, and they were part of a system here, like you said, that I think was symbiotic with what people were going through there. It was kind of a shared history,
right.
Because many of the blacks who came to America came from Africa, most, so there is a real shared history.
Right. I mean, even though, to no disrespect to Oprah, but most of our ancestors came from what's now considered West Africa. We don't really have a historical or genetic link to Southern Africa. But again, it's that idea that this is the birthplace of
right.
our people. And so we're going to try and do whatever we can to help them, regardless of where they are on the continent. And, you mentioned Paul Robeson. I mean, Paul Robeson was like, the biggest, star you can mention now, like Denzel.
Right.
Or Idris Elba or Will Smith.
Combined
with LeBron James, because he was a world-class athlete.
He was more of a renaissance. When I think of Paul Robeson, he's like the quintessential renaissance man.
Exactly.
He was engaged in so many different areas.
Right. But people don't realize how big Paul Robeson was at that time. I mean, Paul Robeson was at his height, and this was a guy taking on and being identified with an ideology that the U.S. government hated, communism, and was open about it. And even when they cracked down on these organizations that were considered subversive, he still stood still, and it cost him his career.
Right. Give me the takeaway. I'm fascinated with the aspect of the book where you talk about this machine that helped make that happen.
Right.
What was the other machine that helped stop it? Because, the coalescence with the sanctions in 86, there had to be a buildup, with a counter movement. So what is your takeaway about both of those machines and where we are now in terms of how much propaganda plays a role in the way people see the world?
Right. Well, to the first question, most of the pushback was done by organizations that had far less money than the South African government, of course. And so it was just like the civil rights struggles or black liberation struggles in this country. It was done by people with few resources, but they felt like they had both history and righteousness on their side.
And so, can I ask you a question? As I remember, wasn't there a lot of pressure on corporations, like threats of boycotts?
Right. And that's one of the things that, people push for universities to divest their holdings in companies that had operations in South Africa. And this is global. But the thing was that this was essentially I would say it gained visibility in 1984 with the Free South Africa movement when Randall Robertson, Elidor Holmes Norton, who's now the D.C. delegate, Walter Fauntleroy, they all staged a sit-in at the South African government embassy in Washington, D.C. on Thanksgiving Day, and that led to this massive Free South Africa movement. Rosa Parks eventually got arrested there. Coretta Scott King eventually. And so they also, used media, existing media at that time, to counter what the South African government was doing. So it was the same kind of thing, except that it was open and it was in front, and they didn't create fake groups like the South African government did to show support.
Well, then I guess my final question is, propaganda, bad or good? I mean, it is a tool to further one's...
Right. I mean, there's a black psychiatrist in Oakland, California, named Dr. Wade Nobles. And one of his famous things is that power is the ability to define reality and have others accept that reality as their own. You know, that's what, you know, propaganda ever. I mean, even if we call it propaganda, it seems like it has negative connotations, but that's what advertising is. I mean, it creates this reality for you, and you believe it. I mean, you want to look like Beyonce. You know, you want to buy the car that this person has. You know, you see Daniel Craig in the Bond movie, you want to dress like that. You know, because it's product placement. You're pushing this thing that this is cool. Even when
that's what makes capitalism run. I mean, buying things you don't need is the core of the engine.
But even when you look at things like, you know, sometimes and just pay attention to like the drug commercials, prescription drug commercials, there are people running through the park and they're walking their dogs and all because they took this pill, right?
Right.
And
so, but they do at least put the side effects at the end. Right. You can drop over and
but they say it so fast that, you know, you can do this and that and then death and then, you know, but check with your doctor to see if this is right for you. You know, so yeah, it plays a role, and that's what the South African government did. You'll see in the book that they went and hired all of these big firms on Madison Avenue in New York. And in D.C., they hired these big lobbying firms to push this ideology. So it was a big global advertising campaign.
Wow. The book, Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron Nixon, it has been a pleasure talking to you. And keep up the good columns. I'm loving you. You guys need to read his stuff in the New York Times about the northern border, right, which there's so much attention on that southern border, right, that, you know, really good writing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. And I want to thank Ron Nixon. What a great guest. Time for a break, and we'll be back with more news.
Hope Policy Institute provides independent, nonpartisan analysis of public and private policies that affect the financial security of Mid-South families and communities. Hope's work supports efforts to create an environment that ensures that all people, no matter where they live, have the opportunity to prosper. Together, we can improve the lives of people in our community. Together, there is hope. HopePolicy.org. Hope Enterprise Corporation is a family of development organizations dedicated to strengthening communities, building assets, and improving lives in the Delta and other economically distressed parts of Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Together, we can improve the lives of people in our community. Learn more about Hope's work to create opportunity where it is needed most. Hope-EC.org.
The weathercasts on WJSU are underwritten by Ingalls Shipbuilding in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Ingalls is an equal opportunity employer, hiring electricians, machinists, ship fitters, pipe fitters, and pipe welders. Positions are union represented. Information at 888-935-1507 or the Ingalls website at huntingtoningalls.com/careers.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current, WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. Let's look at some of the top stories around the country today. Presidential nominee Donald Trump says his first presidential act would be to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Trump told supporters at a rally in Sanford, Florida, that he would immediately, quote, ask Congress to put a bill on my desk to get rid of this disastrous program, adding, it will be so easy. Trump has been trying to seize on the act as a potent issue following word that average premiums under the law will jump sharply in 2017. Here's what else he had to say today.
Obamacare is just blowing up, and even the White House, our president, announced 25 or 26%. That number is so wrong. That is such a phony number. You're talking about 60, 70, 80% in increases, not 25%.
And former President Bill Clinton weighed in on the debate.
All the headlines are full of the stories that average premiums are going up 22%. But the subheadline is, if you're in the health care program, your subsidies will go up too, so the increases won't be as much.
Stay tuned on Obamacare News, because obviously something's going to have to be done to keep the program solvent. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell says he will vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. The Republican and retired four-star Army general is the latest in a series of Bush administration officials who have rejected their party's nominee. Powell recently engaged in a public fight with Clinton when he denied her claim that he advised the Democratic nominee to set up a private email server as Secretary of State. Many high-profile Republicans have been running away from Trump, and not only as a political nominee, but AP's Rita Foley reports that Trump's business deals may suffer as a result of his run for the presidency.
Trump claims the marketing value of his name alone is worth $3 billion. But experts say the name and the brand have lost some of their panache. One expert saying the Trump brand is collapsing among those with a household income of over $100,000 a year. Those mostly wealthy customers who have stayed at his hotels, played golf at his golf courses, or held galas at his oceanside resorts. Trump denies this is true and says, in fact, his campaign may be helping business. I'm Rita Foley.
The American Academy of Pediatrics is calling for infants to be kept in their parents' bedroom at night for 6 months to a year to reduce the risk of sleep-related death. The new recommendations say babies should sleep on a separate service. AP's Ben Thomas files this report.
The American Academy of Pediatrics is now recommending parents keep newborns in their own bedroom at night, however not in the same bed. It says babies should sleep in a crib or bassinet and never on something soft or surrounded by blankets and pillows. About 3,500 infants suffer sleep-related deaths every year in the U.S., and the Academy says such steps could reduce that by as much as 50%.
In Mississippi news, a lawyer for a South Mississippi school district says a student has been disciplined following allegations that one or more white students put a noose around the neck of a black football player. Sean Courtney, the attorney for the Stone County School District, wrote today in an email that administrators determined that the school's conduct code was violated in the October 13th incident. He added that a student was disciplined after due process in accordance with district policies. Courtney says he can't name the student or the specific punishment, citing privacy rules. Though sheriff's deputies are investigating, Courtney says there was no indication of a crime in what was reported to staff members. Mississippi NAACP President Derek Johnson called for a federal hate crimes investigation yesterday as the student's parents stood beside him. Courtney says Johnson's allegations that the district didn't follow its policies are patently false. A center dedicated to the memory of slain black teen Emmett Till has raised over $20,000 to replace the bullet-riddled sign commemorating the 1955 Mississippi killing that helped propel the civil rights movement. The Clarion Ledger reports that the money raised by the Emmett Till Interpretive Center is about 10 times the amount of money it will cost to replace the historical marker. The historic sign has been a repeated target of vandals and was recently found to be damaged with bullet holes. And a former deputy tax collector for Tallahatchie County has pleaded guilty to embezzlement and has been sentenced to 18 months of supervised probation. State Auditor Stacy Pickering, in a news release today, said Deltra Young also was served in February with a formal demand for $19,486. Pickering says his office has already returned the amount of embezzled funds to the county from Young's bond. That's going to be our show for today. I want to thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to catch Metro Morning Live with Rob J. tomorrow at 7 a.m. and again at 10 on JSU TV, Comcast Channel 14. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow for the Full Spectrum at 4 right here on 88.5. Or you can catch us online at WJSU.org. Up next, Latin Jazz with host Dale Morris.